Lesson 10. Pleasing personality. You can do it if you believe you can. What is a pleasing personality? It is a personality that attracts, and in this lesson, we will look at what causes that attraction and how to create it. Your personality is the sum total of your characteristics and appearances that distinguish you from all others. The clothes you wear, the lines in your face, the tone of your voice, the thoughts you think, the character you have developed by those thoughts all constitute parts of your personality. Whether your personality is attractive or not is another matter. By far, the most important part of your personality is that which is represented by your character. Therefore, it is also the part that is not visible. The style of your clothes and their appropriateness undoubtedly constitutes a very important part of your personality, for it is true that people form first impressions of you from your outward appearance. Even the way you shake hands forms an important part of your personality and goes a long way toward attracting or repelling those with whom you shake hands. This art can be cultivated. The expression in your eyes also forms an important part of your personality, for there are people, and they are more numerous than one might imagine, who can look through your eyes into your heart and see the nature of your most secret thoughts. The vitality of your body, sometimes called personal magnetism, also constitutes an important part of your personality. Elements of a pleasing personality. There is one way in which you can express the composite of your personality so that it will always attract, even though you may seem outwardly unattractive, and this is by taking an honest interest in other people. Let me illustrate exactly what I mean by relating an incident that happened some years ago from which I was taught a lesson in master salesmanship. You too may learn that lesson from this incident. One day, an elderly lady called at my office and sent in her card with a message saying that she must see me personally. No amount of coaxing by secretaries could induce her to disclose the nature of her visit. Therefore, I made up my mind that she was some poor old soul who wanted to sell me a book. Thinking of my own mother, I decided to go out to the reception room and buy her book, whatever it might be. As I walked down the hallway from my private office, this lady, who was standing just outside of the railing that led to the main reception room, began to smile. I had seen many people smile, but never before had I seen one who smiled so sweetly as did this lady. It was one of those contagious smiles, because I caught the spirit of it and began to smile too. As I reached the railing, the lady extended her hand to shake hands with me. Now, as a rule, I do not become too friendly on first acquaintance when a person calls at my office, for the reason that it is very hard to say no if the caller should ask me to do something that I do not wish to do. However, this dear lady looked so sweetly innocent and harmless that I extended my hand and she began to shake it, whereupon I discovered that she not only had an attractive smile, but she also had a magnetic handshake. She took hold of my hand firmly, but not too firmly, and the very manner in which she went about it telegraphed the thought that it was she who was doing the honors. She made me feel that she was really and truly glad to shake my hand, and I believe that she was. I believe that her handshake came from her heart, as well as from her hand. I have shaken hands with many thousands of people during my public career, but I do not recall ever having done so with anyone who understood the art of doing it as well as this lady did. The moment she touched my hand, I could feel myself slipping, and I knew that whatever it was that she had come after, she would go away with it, and that I would aid and abet her all I could toward this end. That penetrating smile and that warm handshake had disarmed me and made me a willing victim. At a single stroke, this lady had cut through the false shell into which I crawl when salespeople come around. This gentle visitor had neutralized my mind and made me want to listen. Ah, but here is the point at which most salespeople stumble. For it is as useless to try to sell someone anything until you have first made them want to listen as it would be to command the earth to stop rotating. Note how well this elderly lady used a smile and a handshake as the tools with which to pry open a doorway to my heart. Slowly and deliberately, as if she had all the time in the world, which she did have as far as I was concerned at that moment, she began to crystallize the first step of her victory into reality by saying, "I just came here to tell you that I think you are doing the most wonderful work of any man in the world today." Every word was emphasized by a gentle, though firm, squeeze of my hand, and she was looking through my eyes and into my heart as she spoke. After I regained consciousness, for it became a standing joke among my assistants at the office that I fainted dead away, I reached down and unlocked the little secret latch that fastened the gate and said, "Come right in, dear lady. Come right into my private office." And with a gallant bow that would have done credit to the cavaliers of olden times, I bade her come in and sit a while. As she entered my private office, I motioned her to the big easy chair behind my desk, while I took the little hard-seated chair which, under ordinary circumstances, I would have used as a means of discouraging her from taking up too much of my time. For 3/4 of an hour, I listened to one of the most brilliant and charming conversations I have ever heard, and my visitor was doing all of the conversing. From the very start, she had assumed the initiative and taken the lead, and up to the end of that first 3/4 of an hour, she found no inclination on my part to challenge her right to it. I repeat, lest you did not get the full importance of it, that I was a willing listener. Now comes the part of the story that could make me blush with embarrassment. As I have stated, my visitor entranced me with a brilliant and captivating conversation for all of that time, and not once did she use the personal pronoun I. Now, what do you suppose she had been talking about? Was she trying to sell me a book? No. However, she was not only trying, but actually selling me something, and that something was myself. She had no sooner been seated in that big cushioned chair than she unrolled a package, and sure enough, there was a book in the package, in fact, several of them. But what she had was a complete year's file of the magazine of which I was then editor, Hill's Golden Rule. She turned the pages of those magazines and read places that she had marked here and there, assuring me in the meanwhile that she had always believed the philosophy behind that which she was reading. Then, after I was in a state of complete mesmerism and thoroughly receptive, my visitor tactfully switched the conversation to a subject which, I suspect, she had in mind to discuss with me long before she presented herself at my office. But, and this is another point at which most salespeople blunder, had she reversed the order of her conversation and begun where she finished, the chances are that she never would have had the opportunity to sit in that big easy chair. During the last 3 minutes of her visit, she skillfully laid before me the merits of some securities that she was selling. She did not ask me to purchase, but the way in which she told me about the securities had the psychological effect of making me want to purchase. And even though I made no purchase of securities from her, she made a sale, because I picked up the telephone and introduced her to a man to whom she later sold more than 5 times the amount that she had intended selling me. If that same woman, or another woman, or a man, who had the tact and pleasing personality that she had, should call on me, I would again sit down and listen for 3/4 of an hour. We are all human, and we are all more or less vain, and we are all alike in this respect. We will listen with intense interest to those who talk to us about that which lies closest to our hearts. Then, out of a sense of reciprocity, we will also listen with interest when the speaker finally switches the conversation to the subject that lies closest to his or her heart, and in the end, we will not only sign on the dotted line, but we will also say, "What a wonderful personality." In the city of Chicago, some years ago, I was conducting a sales course for an investment house which employed more than 1,500 salespeople. To keep the ranks of that big organization filled, we had to train and employ 600 new salespeople every week. Of all the thousands of men and women who went through that school, there was but one man who grasped the significance of the principle I have just described. This man had never tried to sell securities, and frankly admitted when he entered the class that he was not a salesman. After he had finished his training, one of the star salesmen, a man by the name of Perkins, took a notion to play a practical joke on him. This star gave him an inside tip as to where he would be able to sell some securities without any great effort. Perkins would make the sale himself, so he said, but the man to whom he referred as being a likely purchaser was an ordinary artist who would purchase with so little urging that he, being a star, did not wish to waste his time on him. The new salesman was delighted to receive the tip and went quickly on his way to make the sale. As soon as he was out of the office, the star gathered the other stars around him and told of the joke he was playing, for in reality, the artist was a very wealthy man, and Perkins himself had spent nearly a month trying to sell him, but without success. It then came out that all of the stars of that particular group had also called on this same artist, but had failed to interest him. The new salesman was gone about an hour and a half. When he returned, he found the stars waiting for him with smiles on their faces. To their surprise, this new salesman also wore a broad smile on his face. They looked at each other inquiringly. "Well, did you sell to your man?" inquired the originator of this joke. "Certainly," replied the uninitiated one. "And I found that artist to be all you said he was, a perfect gentleman and a very interesting man." Reaching into his pocket, he pulled out an order and a check for $2,000. The stars wanted to know how he did it. "Oh, it wasn't difficult," replied the new salesman. "I just walked in and talked to him a few minutes, and he brought up the subject of the securities himself and said he wanted to purchase. Therefore, I really did not sell to him. He purchased of his own accord." When I heard of the transaction, I called this new salesman in and asked him to describe, in detail, just how he made the sale. He said that when he reached the artist's studio, he found him at work on a picture. So engaged in his work was the artist that he did not see the salesman enter. So the salesman walked over to where he could see the picture and stood there looking at it without saying a word. Finally, the artist saw him. Then the salesman apologized for the intrusion and began to talk about the picture the artist was painting. He knew just enough about art to be able to discuss the merits of the picture with some intelligence, and he was really interested in the subject. He liked the picture and frankly told the artist so. For nearly an hour, those two men talked of nothing but art, particularly the picture that stood on the artist's easel. Finally, the artist asked the salesman his name and his business, and the salesman replied, "Oh, never mind my business or my name. I am more interested in you and your art." The artist beamed. But not to be outdone by his polite visitor, he insisted on knowing what mission had brought him to his studio. Then, with an air of genuine reluctance, this salesman, this real star, introduced himself and told his business. Briefly, he described the securities he was selling, and the artist listened as if he enjoyed every word that was spoken. After the salesman had finished, the artist said, "Well, well, other salesmen from your firm have been here trying to sell me some of those securities, but they talked nothing but business. In fact, they annoyed me so that I had to ask one of them to leave. I believe his name was Perkins, but you present the matter so differently, and I want you to let me have $2,000 worth of those securities." Remember that. You present the matter so differently. And how did this new salesman present the matter so differently? What did this master salesman really sell that artist? Did he sell him securities? No. He sold him his own picture that he was painting on his own canvas. The securities were almost incidental. It happens that in a class attended by this new salesman early on, I had told the story of the elderly lady who entertained me for 3/4 of an hour by talking about that which was nearest to my heart, and it had so impressed him that he made up his mind to study his prospective purchasers and find out what would interest them most so he could talk about that. This green salesman earned $7,900 in commissions the first month he was in the field, leading the next highest man by more than double. And the tragedy of that was that not one person out of the entire organization of 1,500 salespeople took the time to find out how and why he became the real star of the organization. The editor's comment. As noted earlier, throughout this revised and updated edition of The Law of Success, the editors have made it a practice to suggest relevant books and audiobooks by other authors that relate to the principles and concepts presented by Napoleon Hill in his original manuscript. That being the case, in this section you would expect to find one or two suggestions for books on salesmanship. But because salesmanship is a subject that has been written about so extensively, selecting a mere one or two examples would have proven almost impossible had it not been for a gentleman with the unusual name of Og Mandino and Napoleon Hill himself. Mandino's personal story is far too powerful to do it justice in the few lines available here, but you should know something of his background in order to understand why we have singled out his book. In brief, when Og Mandino returned a decorated hero after his service in World War II, he struggled for a year trying to make a go of it as a writer in New York City. When his savings were exhausted, he started on a 15-year merry-go-round of brief ups, followed by crashing downs that finally brought him so low he was literally a drunken bum on the streets of Cleveland, too poor to buy a gun to commit suicide. Then, in a public library, he came across a copy of Success Through a Positive Mental Attitude, the classic motivational book co-written by Napoleon Hill and W. Clement Stone. It transformed his life. With a renewed sense of purpose, Ogmandino set out for Boston, where he managed to convince the people at W. Clement Stone's Combined Insurance Company of America that they should hire him as an insurance salesman. Within 3 years, he had elevated himself within the organization to the point where he was named to the position of executive editor of Success Unlimited, a magazine published by Stone and Hill. A few years later, in 1968, a New York publisher took a chance on this first-time author and published Mandino's book, The Greatest Salesman in the World. The details of Ogmandino's life, only hinted at here, and the equally extraordinary story of how his book earned its success, are intentionally being left for you to discover on your own. However, we will tell you this. The Greatest Salesman in the World has sold well over 4 million copies, has gone through more than 130 printings in 17 languages, and is widely acknowledged as the best-selling book about sales in the entire world. The second source of additional material that the editors recommend is the audiobook Selling You. It is a two-cassette program based on Napoleon Hill's bestseller How to Sell Your Way Through Life, which is not currently available, but there are plans to reprint it in the future. The audio program is narrated by Joe Slattery, features an introduction by W. Clement Stone, and is augmented by archival recordings of Napoleon Hill personally explaining some of his most compelling ideas. It also includes a 32-page booklet featuring additional sales techniques. Returning now to Napoleon Hill's original text. A Carnegie or a Rockefeller or a James J. Hill or a Marshall Field accumulates a fortune through the application of the self-same principles that are available to all of us. But we envy them their wealth without ever thinking of studying their philosophy and applying it to ourselves. We look at a successful man in the hour of his triumph and wonder how he did it, but we overlook the importance of analyzing his methods. We forget the price he had to pay in careful, well-organized preparation, which had to be made before he could reap the fruits of his efforts. Throughout this course on the law of success, you will not find a single new principle. Every one of them is as old as civilization itself, yet you will find few people who seem to understand how to apply them. The salesman who sold those securities to that artist was not only a master salesman, but he was also a man with a pleasing personality. He was not much to look at, and perhaps that is why the star conceived the idea of playing the joke on him. But even a homely person may have a very attractive personality in the eyes of those whose handiwork he is praised. Of course, there are some who will get the wrong idea of the principle by drawing the conclusion that any sort of cheap flattery will take the place of genuine heart interest. I hope that you are not one of these. I hope that you are one who understands the real psychology on which this lesson is based, and that you will make it your business to study other people closely enough to find something about them or their work that you genuinely admire. Only in this way can you develop a personality that will be irresistibly attractive. Cheap flattery has just the opposite effect to that of constituting a pleasing personality. It repels instead of attracting. It is so shallow that even the ignorant easily detect it. Perhaps you have noticed that this lesson emphasizes at length the importance of making it your business to take a keen interest in other people and in their work, business, or profession. You will quickly observe that the principles upon which this lesson is based are very closely related to those that constitute the foundation of Lesson 6, Volume 2, on imagination, as well as on many of the same general principles as those that form the most important part of Lesson 13, Volume 4, on cooperation. Selling you and your ideas. I would like to introduce some very practical suggestions as to how the laws of imagination, cooperation, and pleasing personality can be coordinated to create usable ideas. Every thinker knows that ideas are the beginning of all successful achievement. The question most often asked, however, is, how can I learn to create ideas that will earn money? In part, we will answer that question in this lesson by suggesting some novel ideas that might be developed and made very profitable by almost anyone in practically any locality. Commentary from the editors. A 1998 column in the Houston Business Journal by syndicated columnist and business consultant Scott Clark of the HTC Group offers some interesting insight into the entrepreneurial process. He writes that while financiers perceive management, opportunity, and resources as the three driving forces behind any business venture, most entrepreneurs focus on just one driving force, opportunity. Although they define this as their product idea, an idea is just a brainstorm that seems to have great possibilities. If an entrepreneur learns of someone else with the same idea, they believe it was stolen from them. Clark says that when we are exposed to a sufficient number of life events and are able to filter them creatively, an idea may emerge. Others who have been exposed to the same events under different circumstances are still capable of conceiving the same ideas. As a result, most of the great ideas in business science history have been simultaneously developed by several people who had no direct contact with each other. Examples include the airplane, the integrated circuit, and the computer, each invented concurrently by two people at remote locations from each other. What transforms an idea into an opportunity that will interest investors, says Clark, is determining a use that consumers really want, then being able to implement it at an affordable price. Most entrepreneurs just devise an interesting concept, conduct market research by asking their friends what they think, then use that feedback to justify leaving their jobs and starting a business. Clark explains that what they should do first is identify a specific market need, conduct extensive market research to verify the strength and price point of that need, then develop a marketing strategy to meet the demand. This business opportunity must then be verified before considering opening a new business and approaching financiers. As for management and resources, Clark says that when financiers scrutinize a potential business deal, the first thing they look at is not the opportunity, but the strength of the management team. According to George Dorio, one of the founders of Modern Venture Capital, always consider investing in a grade A entrepreneur with a grade B idea, but never invest in a grade B entrepreneur with a grade A idea. If you don't present the image of experience, the appropriate background, as well as a detailed understanding of your market, investors will never provide you with the resources. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. Idea number one. If, for example, you wanted to manufacture toys, you would have to determine what sort of toys to manufacture and where to get the capital with which to operate the business. First, go to your local toy store and find out which toys are currently selling best. If you do not feel competent to make improvements on some of the toys now on the market, advertise for an inventor with an idea for a marketable toy, and you will soon find a person who will supply this missing link. Have that inventor make you a working model, then go to some small manufacturer and arrange to have your toy manufactured. You now know just what your toy will cost, so you are ready to go to some big jobber, wholesaler, or distributor and arrange for the sale of your product. If you are a good salesperson, you can finance this whole project on the few dollars required to advertise for the inventor. When you find this person, you can probably arrange with them to create a model for you, with the promise that you will give them a better job when you are manufacturing your own toys, or they may do the work in return for an interest in the business. You should be able to get the manufacturer of your toys to wait for their money until you are paid by the firm to which you sell them, and, if necessary, you can assign to the manufacturer the invoices for the toys sold and let the money come directly to them. Of course, if you have an unusually pleasing and convincing personality and considerable ability to organize, you will be able to take the model of your toy to someone of means and, in return for an interest in the business, secure the capital with which to do your own manufacturing. Common sense is all that is necessary. Simply find out what the people want and then produce it. Produce it well, better than anyone else is doing. Give it a touch of individuality. Make it distinctive. We spend millions of dollars annually for toys to entertain our children. Make your new toy useful as well as interesting. Make it educational if possible. If it entertains and teaches at the same time, it will sell readily and live forever. If your toy is a game, make it teach the child something about the world, such as geography, arithmetic, English, science, and so on. Or better still, produce a toy that will cause the child to exercise. Editor's comment. In hearing Napoleon Hill's example of starting a toy company, you may have thought to yourself, how quaint, toy trucks and rag dolls, but that idea belongs to another era. You could never do that today. Be assured, the basic principles Hill outlines are exactly the principles upon which companies making today's latest computer games are founded. And not only can you do it today, but someone is doing it right now. Every January or February in New York City and Lower Manhattan, where Broadway and Fifth Avenue intersect, as well as at the Javits Convention Center, Toy Fair happens. Everybody who is anybody in the toy business is there displaying their latest toys and games and trying to convince the buyers for the major retail stores that they've got the one that's going to be the big seller at Christmas. And every year, just like at any other trade show, the big guys have the big displays and the big announcements. And every year, some little guy with nothing more than a 10x10 booth and an original idea will catch the fancy of the buyers. Clearly, the editors acknowledge that it's the big toy companies that consistently turn out the best-selling toys. The well-known brands have the resources to develop many different lines each year for Toy Fair, and they have established relationships with the buyers. But it is surprising how often it's been a little guy who had the hit of the show that really did become the big seller the following Christmas. Toy companies aside, the larger point that Hill was making was that new products are coming into the market all the time, and not all of them are created by established companies. It was true when Hill first wrote The Law of Success, and it remains true. As this updated edition is being written, new products are still being created, and someone with imagination and a pleasing personality is getting the cooperation of other people to help finance and manufacture those products. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. Idea number 2. This will be of interest only to the man or woman who has the self-confidence and the ambition to run the risk of making a big income, which, I might add, most people do not have. It is intended for the man or woman who is creative and has the talent to write advertising and sales materials. To make practical and profitable use of this suggestion, you will need the cooperation of a good advertising agency and from 1 to 5 firms or individuals who do enough advertising to warrant going through an agency. This is where you will need imagination, cooperation, and a pleasing personality because you will need to go to the agency and sell them on the idea of paying you a percentage on the gross expenditures of all accounts that you bring to it. This percentage is to compensate you for getting the account and for writing the copy and otherwise serving the client in the management of their advertising. Then you go to a firm or individual whose advertising account you wish to handle and say in effect that you wish to go to work without compensation. Tell what you can do and what you intend to do for that particular firm that will help them sell more goods. If the firm employs an advertising manager, you are to become virtually his or her assistant without pay, on one condition, that the company's advertising is to be placed through the agency with which you have the connection. Through this arrangement, the firm or individual whose account you thus secure will get the benefit of your personal services without cost and will pay no more for placing its advertising through your agency than it would through any other. If you are convincing and you really take the time to prepare your case, you will get your account without much argument. You will give the advertising agency a reputation for effective service, and you will please your clients because they will see satisfactory returns from your efforts. As long as you keep the agency and the clients whom you serve satisfied, your job is safe and you will make money. You can repeat this transaction until you have as many accounts as you can handle. You can see that the plan has possibilities. It supplies independent work and gives you 100% of your earning power. It is better than a position as advertising manager, even if the position paid the same money, because it practically places you in a business of your own, one in which your name is constantly developing a survival value. Idea number 3. This plan can be put into operation by almost any man or woman of average intelligence and with little preparation. Go to any first-class printer and make arrangements with them to handle all the business you bring them, allowing you a commission of, say, 10% on the gross amount. Then go to the largest users of printed matter and get samples of everything in the way of printing that they use. Form a partnership or working arrangement with a commercial artist who will go over all this printed matter and, wherever suitable or appropriate, improve the illustrations. Then, if you are not a writer of copy, form a working arrangement with someone who is, and get him or her to go over the copy of the printed materials and improve them in every respect possible. When the work is complete, go back to the firm from which you get the printed matter and show how much more effective you can make it. If you perform your service properly, you will soon have all the business that your commercial artist, your copywriter, and you can handle. Any profits that you earn from the work of others will be a legitimate profit in return for your ability to organize and bring together the necessary talent and ability with which to perform satisfactory service. From the editors. Napoleon Hill's second and third suggestions are really variations on the same theme, and no doubt he chose these examples because he had personally succeeded in doing something very similar. Although Hill was always a writer, the difference between being a writer and being an author was years of research and hard work. During those years, he often put his talents to work as a freelancer writing promotional and advertising materials. Since Hill's time, advertising and marketing have overlapped into other areas and become a part of a larger whole that is vaguely referred to as the media. This amorphous thing called the media now encompasses everything from the copywriters and illustrators that Hill was familiar with, to computer graphics designers, specialized artists, photographers, performers, interactive game designers, digital animators, infomercial producers, product placement specialists, creators of websites, and consultants of every stripe. As new and different as all of these media types may seem, Napoleon Hill would have been right at home with them. Like Hill, they are either freelancers themselves, or they rely on freelancers to run their business. Just as you don't have to be the one who creates a toy in order to create a successful toy manufacturing company, in the service industry, it's not essential that you be the writer or the computer designer to launch a successful media company. What you do need is the imagination to find out what kind of talent and services are in demand, and who the people or businesses are who need those talents. Combine that imaginative idea with the kind of pleasing personality that can elicit the cooperation of freelancers who have the talents to fill that demand, and you have just taken Napoleon Hill's 1928 business model as a blueprint for creating a leading-edge media company. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. You want to stop being an employee and become an employer. I do not blame you for that. Most people want to do the same. The best first step to take is to serve the firm or individual for whom you are working, just as you would wish to be served if you were that individual or head of that firm. Who are the big employers today? They are the men and women who came up from the ranks, men and women who have had no greater opportunity than you have. They are in the positions that they hold because their superior ability has enabled them to intelligently direct others. You can acquire that ability if you will try. Right in the town or city where you live, there are people who probably could benefit by knowing you, and who could undoubtedly benefit you in return. In one section of the city lives John Smith, who wishes to sell his grocery store and open a movie theater. In another section of the city is a man who has a movie theater that he would like to trade for a grocery store. Can you bring them together? If you can, you will serve both and earn a nice commission. In your town or city are people who want the products raised on the farms in the surrounding community. On those farms are farmers who raise farm products and who want to get them into the hands of those who live in town. If you can find a way of carrying the farm products direct from the farm to the city or town consumer, you will enable the farmer to get more for his products and the consumer to get those products for less. And still, there will be a margin to pay you for your ingenuity in shortening the route between producer and consumer. If you can create such a plan to shorten that route within any business, you are entitled to a fair percentage of what you save for the consumer and also a fair percentage of what you make for the producer. And let me warn you that whatever plan you create is a means of making money, you had better see that it slices off a little of the cost to the consumer instead of adding a little to that cost. If you crave wealth and are really brave enough to shoulder the burdens that go with it, reverse the usual method of acquiring it by giving your goods and wares to the world at the lowest possible profit you can afford, instead of exacting all that you can with safety. The business of bringing producer and consumer together is a profitable business when it is conducted fairly to both, without a greedy desire to get all that you can. The American public is wonderfully patient with profiteers, but there is a point beyond which even the shrewdest dare not go. There may be some perfectly good plans through which you could squeeze the consumer and still manage to keep out of jail. But you will enjoy much more peace of mind, and in all probability more profits in the long run, if your plan is built along the lines of Henry Ford's, who found it profitable to pay his workers not as little as he could get them for, but as much as his profits would permit. He also found it profitable to reduce the price of his automobile to the consumer, while other manufacturers, many of whom have long since failed, continued to increase theirs. John D. Rockefeller has been abused considerably, but most of this abuse has been prompted by sheer envy on the part of those who would like to have his money but who haven't the inclination to earn it. Regardless of your opinion of Rockefeller, do not forget that he began as a humble bookkeeper and that he gradually climbed to the top because of his ability to organize and direct others intelligently. I can remember when I had to pay 25 cents for a gallon of lamp oil and walk 2 miles through the hot sun and carry it home in a tin can. Now Rockefeller's wagon will deliver it at the back door, in a city or on the farm, at a little over half that sum. Who has a right to begrudge Rockefeller his millions as long as he has reduced the price of a needed commodity? He could just as easily have increased the price of lamp oil to half a dollar, but I seriously doubt that he would be a multimillionaire today if he had done so. There are a lot of us who want money, but 99 out of every 100 who start to create a plan through which to get money give all their thought to the scheme through which to get it, and no thought to the service to be given in return for it. Editor's comment. In Time Magazine's 100 Most Important People of the 20th Century, an article by Grace Mirabella, former Vogue editor-in-chief and founder of Mirabella Magazine, quotes Leonard Lauder, chief executive of the Estee Lauder Cosmetics Company, as saying his mother always thought that she was growing a nice little business. Estee Lauder, while living above her father's hardware store in a section of Queens, New York, began selling creams created by her uncle, who was a chemist. Long before getting her products into major stores, she was selling them in beauty shops, beach clubs, and resorts. In the beginning, the only person available to answer the phones changed her voice to become the shipping or billing department as needed. Later, Estee Lauder is said to have stalked the bosses at Saks Fifth Avenue until she got counter space, where her personal selling approach, including promotions and samples, was instrumental in her success. In addition to being extremely focused and a quality fanatic, Estee Lauder outworked everyone else in the cosmetics industry. Leonard Lauder attributes his mother's success to ambition. Former Neiman Marcus chief Stanley Marcus was obviously referring to Lauder's pleasing personality when he said, "She was determined and gracious and lovely through it all. It was easier to say yes to Estee than to say no." At the end of the century, that nice little business controlled 45% of the cosmetics market in U.S. department stores, had $3.6 billion in sales in 118 countries, and the Lauder family shares were worth more than $6 billion. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. A pleasing personality is one that makes use of imagination and cooperation. I have cited the foregoing illustrations of how ideas may be created to show you how to coordinate the laws of imagination, cooperation, and a pleasing personality. Analyze any person who does not have a pleasing personality, and you will also find lacking in that person the faculties of imagination and cooperation. The persuasive personality. This brings us to a suitable place at which to introduce one of the greatest lessons on personality ever placed on paper. It is also one of the most effective lessons on salesmanship ever written, for the subjects of pleasing personality and salesmanship must always go hand in hand. They are inseparable. I am referring to Shakespeare's masterpiece, Mark Antony's speech at the funeral of Caesar. I present it here with my bracketed interpretations, which may help you to gather a new meaning from it. The setting for that oration was something like this. Caesar is dead, and Brutus, his slayer, is called on to tell the Roman mob, which has gathered at the undertaker's, why he put Caesar out of the way. Imagine a howling mob that was none too friendly to Caesar, and which already believed that Brutus had done a noble deed by murdering him. Brutus takes the platform and makes a short statement of his reasons for killing Caesar. Confident that he has won the day, he takes his seat. His whole demeanor is that of one who believes his word will be accepted without question. It is one of haughtiness. Mark Antony now takes the platform, knowing that the mob is antagonistic to him, because he was a friend of Caesar's. In a low, humble tone of voice, Antony begins to speak. Antony says, "For Brutus' sake, I am beholding to you." Fourth citizen, "What does he say of Brutus?" Third citizen, "He says, for Brutus' sake, he finds himself beholding to us all."
Fourth Citizen. 'Twere best he speak no harm of Brutus here. First Citizen. This Caesar was a tyrant. Third Citizen. Nay, that's certain. We are blessed that Rome is rid of him. Second Citizen. Peace! Let us hear what Antony can say. Here you will observe, in Antony's opening sentence, his clever method of neutralizing the minds of his listeners. Antony. You gentle Romans. All. Peace, ho! Let us hear him. Had Antony begun his speech by knocking Brutus, the history of Rome would have been different. Antony. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. Align himself with what he knew to be the state of mind of his listeners. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. If it were so, it was a grievous fault. And grievously hath Caesar answered it. Here, under leave of Brutus and the rest. For Brutus is an honorable man. So are they all honorable men. Come I to speak at Caesar's funeral. He was my friend, faithful, and just to me. But Brutus says he was ambitious. And Brutus is an honorable man. He hath brought many captives home to Rome, whose ransoms did the general coffers fill. Did this in Caesar seem ambitious? When the poor have cried, Caesar hath wept. Ambition should be made of sterner stuff. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. You all did see that on the Lupercal. I thrice presented him a kingly crown, which he did thrice refuse. Was this ambition? Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and surely he is an honorable man. I speak not to disprove what Brutus spoke, but here I am to speak what I do know. You all did love him once, not without cause. What cause withholds you then to mourn for him? O judgment, thou art fled to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reason. Bear with me, my heart is in the coffin, there, with Caesar, and I must pause till it come back to me. At this point, Antony paused to give his audience a chance to discuss hurriedly, among themselves, his opening statements. His object in doing this was to observe what effect his words were having, just as a master salesman always encourages his prospective purchaser to talk so he may know what is in their mind. First Citizen. Methinks there is much in his saying. Second Citizen. If thou consider rightly of the matter, Caesar has had great wrong. Third Citizen. Has he, masters? I fear there will be worse come in his place. Fourth Citizen. Marked ye his words? He would not take the crown? Therefore 'tis certain he was not ambitious. First Citizen. If it be found so, someone will dear abide it. Second Citizen. Poor soul! His eyes are red as fire with weeping. Third Citizen. There's not a nobler man in Rome than Antony. Fourth Citizen. Now mark him. He begins again to speak. Antony. But yesterday the word of Caesar might have stood against the world. Now lies he there, and none so poor to do him reverence. O masters, appealing to their vanity, if I were disposed to stir your hearts and minds to mutiny and rage, I should do Brutus wrong and Cassius wrong, who, you all know, are honorable men. Observe how often Antony has repeated the term honorable. Observe also how cleverly he brings in the first suggestion that perhaps Brutus and Cassius may not be as honorable as the Roman mob believes them to be. This suggestion is carried in the words mutiny and rage, which he uses for the first time here, after his pause gave him time to observe that the mob was swinging over to his side of the argument. Observe how carefully he is feeling his way and making his words fit what he knows to be the frame of mind of his listeners. Antony. I will not do them wrong. I rather choose to wrong the dead, to wrong myself and you. then I will wrong such honorable men." Crystallizing his suggestion into hatred of Brutus and Cassius, he then appeals to their curiosity and begins to lay the foundation for his climax, a climax which he knows will win the mob because he is reaching it so cleverly that the mob believes it to be its own conclusion. "But here's a parchment with the seal of Caesar. I found it in his closet.
'Tis his will.
Let but the commons hear this testament, which, pardon me, I do not mean to read." Tightening up on his appeal to their curiosity by making them believe he does not intend to read the will. "And they would go and kiss dead Caesar's wounds, and dip their napkins in his sacred blood, yea, beg a hair of him for memory, and dying, mention it within their wills, bequeathing it as a rich legacy unto their issue." Human nature always wants that which is difficult to get, or that of which it is about to be deprived. Observe how craftily Antony has awakened the interest of the mob and made them want to hear the reading of the will, thereby preparing them to hear it with open minds. This marks his second step in the process of neutralizing their minds. All. "The will! The will! We will hear Caesar's will!" Antony. "Have patience, gentle friends. I must not read it. It is not meet, you know, how Caesar loved you. You are not wood, you are not stones, but men. And being men, hearing the will of Caesar, it will inflame you." Exactly what he wishes to do. "It will make you mad. 'Tis good you know not that you are his heirs. For if you should, oh, what will come of it?" Fourth Citizen. "Read the will. We'll hear it, Antony. You shall read us the will, Caesar's will." Antony. "Will you be patient? Will you stay a while? I have o'ershot myself to tell you of it. I fear I wrong the honorable men whose daggers have stabbed Caesar. I do fear it." Daggers and stabbed suggest cruel murder. Observe how cleverly Antony injects this suggestion into his speech, and observe also how quickly the mob catches its significance, because, unknown to the mob, Antony has carefully prepared their minds to receive this suggestion. Fourth Citizen. "They were traitors, honorable men." All. "The will, the testament." Second Citizen. "They were villains, murderers. The will." Just what Antony would have said in the beginning, but he knew it would have a more desirable effect if he planted the thought in the minds of the mob and permitted them to say it themselves. Antony. "You will compel me then to read the will? Then make a ring about the corpse of Caesar, and let me show you him that made the will. Shall I descend, and will you give me leave?" This was the point at which Brutus should have begun to look for a back door through which to make his escape. All. "Come down." Second Citizen. "Descend." Third Citizen. "Room for Antony, most noble Antony." Antony. "Nay, press not so upon me. Stand far off." He knew this command would make them want to draw nearer, which is what he wanted them to do. All. "Stand back! Room!" Antony. "If you have tears, prepare to shed them now. You all do know this mantle. I remember the first time ever Caesar put it on. 'Twas on a summer's evening, in his tent. That day he overcame the Nervi. Look, in this place ran Cassius' dagger through. See what a rent the envious Casca made. Through this the well-beloved Brutus stabbed. And, as he plucked his cursed steel away, mark how the blood of Caesar followed it, as rushing out of doors to be resolved, if Brutus so unkindly knocked, or no. For Brutus, as you know, was Caesar's angel. Judge, O you gods, how dearly Caesar loved him. This was the most unkindest cut of all. For when the noble Caesar saw him stab, in gratitude, more strong than traitor's arms, quite vanquished him, then burst his mighty heart. And, in his mantle muffling up his face, even at the base of Pompey's statua, which all the while ran blood, great Caesar fell. Oh, what a fall was there, my countrymen! Then I and you and all of us fell down, while bloody treason flourished over us. Oh, now you weep, and I perceive you feel the dint of pity. These are gracious drops. Kind soul, why weep you when you but behold our Caesar's vesture wounded? Look you here. Here is himself, marred, as you see, with traitors. Observe how Antony now uses the word traitors quite freely, because he knows that it is in harmony with what is in the minds of the Roman mob. First Citizen. Oh, piteous spectacle! Second Citizen. Oh, woeful day! Third Citizen. Oh, woeful day! First Citizen. Oh, most bloody sight! Second Citizen. We will be revenged. Had Brutus been a wise man instead of a braggart, he would have been many miles from the scene by this time. All. Revenge! About! Seek! Burn! Fire! Kill! Slay! Let not a traitor live! Here Antony takes the next step toward crystallizing the frenzy of the mob into action. But, clever salesman that he is, does not try to force this action. Antony. Stay, countrymen! First Citizen. Peace there! Hear the noble Antony! Second Citizen. We'll hear him. We'll follow him. We'll die with him. From these words, Antony knows that he has the mob with him. Observe how he takes advantage of this psychological moment, the moment for which all master salesmen wait. Antony. Good friends, sweet friends, let me not stir you up to such a sudden flood of mutiny. They that have done this deed are honorable. What private griefs they have, alas, I know not, that made them do it. They were wise and honorable, and will, no doubt, with reasons, answer you. I come not, friends, to steal away your hearts. I am no orator as Brutus is, but, as you know me all, a plain, blunt man, that love my friend, and that they know full well that gave me public leave to speak of him. For I have neither wit, nor words, nor worth, action, nor utterance, nor the power of speech to stir men's blood. I only speak right on. I tell you that which you yourselves do know. Show you sweet Caesar's wounds, poor, poor, dumb mouths, and bid them speak for me. But were I Brutus, and Brutus Antony, there an Antony would ruffle up your spirits and put a tongue in every wound of Caesar that should move the stones of Rome to rise in mutiny. All. Will mutiny! First Citizen. We'll burn the house of Brutus. Third Citizen. Away, then! Come seek the conspirators! Antony. Yet hear me, countrymen! Yet hear me speak! All. Peace, ho! Hear Antony, most noble Antony! Antony. Why, friends, you go to do you know not what? Wherein hath Caesar thus deserved your love? Alas, you know not. I must tell you then. You have forgot the will I told you of. Antony is now ready to play his trump card. He is ready to reach his climax. Observe how well he has marshaled his suggestions, step by step, saving until last his most important statement, the one on which he relied for action. In the great field of salesmanship, and in public speaking, many try to reach this point too soon, try to rush the audience or the prospective purchaser, and thereby lose their appeal. All. Most true, the will! Let's stay and hear the will. Antony. Here is the will, and under Caesar's seal. To every Roman citizen he gives, to every several man, 75 drachmas. Second Citizen. Most noble Caesar, will revenge his death. Third Citizen. O royal Caesar! Antony. Hear me with patience. All. Peace, ho! Antony. Moreover, he hath left you all his walks, his private arbors and new-planted orchards on this side Tiber. He hath left them you, and to your heirs, forever, common pleasures, to walk abroad and recreate yourself. Here was a Caesar. When comes such another? First Citizen. Never, never! Come, away, away! We'll burn his body in the holy place, and with the brands, fire the traitors' houses. Take up the body. Second citizen. Go fetch fire. Third citizen. Pluck down benches. Fourth citizen. Pluck down forms, windows, anything. And that was Brutus's finish. He lost his case because he lacked the personality and the good judgment with which to present his argument from the viewpoint of the Roman mob, as Mark Antony did. His whole attitude clearly indicated that he thought pretty well of himself, that he was proud of his deed. We have all seen people who somewhat resemble Brutus in this respect, but if we observe closely, we notice that they do not accomplish very much. Suppose that Mark Antony had mounted the platform in a strutting attitude, and had begun his speech in this way. Now let me tell you, Romans, something about this man Brutus. He is a murderer at heart, and he would have gone no further, for the mob would have howled him down. Go back to the lesson on initiative and leadership, Volume 2, and listen to it again, and as you listen, compare the psychology of it with that of Mark Antony's speech. Observe how the you and not I attitude toward others was emphasized. Observe how this same point is emphasized throughout this course, and especially in Lesson 7, Volume 2, on enthusiasm. Shakespeare was, by far, the most able psychologist and writer known to civilization. For that reason, all of his writings were based on unerring knowledge of the human mind. Throughout this speech, which he placed in the mouth of Mark Antony, you will observe how carefully he assumed the you attitude, so carefully that the Roman mob was sure that its decision was of its own making. Notice, however, that Mark Antony's appeal to the self-interest of the Roman mob was of the crafty type, and was based on the stealth with which dishonest men often make use of this principle in appealing to the excessive desire and greed of their victims. While Mark Antony displayed evidence of great self-control in being able to assume, at the beginning of his speech, an attitude toward Brutus that was not real, at the same time, it is obvious that his entire appeal was based on his knowledge of how to influence the minds of the Roman mob through flattery. The two letters reproduced in Lesson 7 of this course illustrate, in a very concrete way, the value of the you and the fatality of the I appeal. Go back to these letters again and observe how the more successful of the two follows closely the Mark Antony appeal, while the other one is based on an appeal of just the opposite nature. Whether you are writing a sales letter or preaching a sermon or writing an advertisement or a book, you will do well to follow the same principles employed by Mark Antony in his famous speech.